Welcome to the Station of Decapitation Without Your Head. I'm Nasty Neil, and I'm joined by Darren Gear.
Hello.
Hello. And Jeff Allengear.
What up?
Yeah. And they're the Gear brothers. It's not, I didn't just, you know, book two people with last name Gear that weren't connected. That would be weird. But screenwriters and producers of The Retaliators, which I am a big fan of. I was very excited to see this movie.
Oh, hey. Awesome, man.
Yeah. And not just because you're here. I really like it.
That's cool, man.
Theatrical release last week. That had to be exciting.
Oh, total thrill.
Beyond. We went to the local, our local Cineplex, and it was just unbelievable to go. And there was a, you know, pretty packed house, and it was just, it's beyond thrilling.
Yeah. And when did this really start? Like the idea, not even just the idea you make, but when did it become like a serious thing? We're going to make this movie.
Well, the speed of everything was unbelievable. I mean, truly unbelievable. I mean, we were kind of from then all the way till now pinching ourselves in that we had, we wrote it. And within the first thing we did basically was we did two things. We sent it into the blacklist and only expecting to get.
What's the blacklist for people not aware?
Yeah. So the blacklist is a list. It's been around since I think 2003. It's a place where you can send unproduced screenplays, and essentially you get your script gets rated, gets coverage, and they're notoriously very difficult. It's very difficult to get high ratings. And if you get past a certain threshold of ratings, you get on what's called their top list, and then you now have exposure for people in the industry who are looking for scripts. And the blacklist has gotten a really good reputation over the years because from the blacklist, many big films have come out and won Oscars. And, you know, there's a lot of famous examples like Slumdog Millionaire and Argo. And, you know, there's just kind of endless examples of scripts that came from there. So we sent it in truly expecting to get completely destroyed, and we were just kind of going, okay, we'll find out why, you know, we're such horrible writers and what we need to work on. And we sent it in, and I mean, we were just completely shocked. We had great ratings, and we next thing you know, we were on their top list. And within a matter of, I mean, a week or two, we started getting offers coming in for to option the film. We were completely, I mean, truly just flabbergasted. The best thing that we did at the exact same time, right as that was happening, is I sent the script to Michael Lombardi. And he is someone that I had worked with in music 10 years before. We hadn't talked to each other in a while. We had a great, great working relationship when we worked together, and then we stayed in touch, and he happened to just call me out of the blue as we were driving to our first meeting to potentially option the script. And he said, "What are you up to?" We said, "Oh, we're writing screenplays." And he said, send it to me. We sent him The Retaliators. He was on a plane in 3 days. He's on the East Coast, and he flew down in 3 days. And he called us immediately. He said, "Don't do anything. Don't do anything with anybody. I want to meet with you guys." So he came down and basically pitched exactly what would manifest over the next few years. And Jeff and I just really believed him and believed in him, thank God. And he just looked us in the eyes and said, "I will get this movie made. I will get the financing, I will go through hell to get this made because I get the vision. And he did get the vision. He was one of the only people that really got the vision. You know, he understood the homages and the nuances and the sort of craziness of doing what we do in the third act and having the different tones and so that was literally within less than from that day we were in production, principal photography production in about 8 months from there. That's how fast it has. So, I mean, it's just a whole thing was at just truly a breakneck speed. The pandemic hit
right
as we were shooting. So that put an enormous pause on the planet, of course, and then ended up producing many, many, many obstacles for, we were truly early days pandemic shooting and it, which was very rough.
Yeah, because, you know, everyone watching this lived through that. You know, we didn't know how, you know, serious this would become. And
Yeah. So it caused our sets got shut down. Early days of COVID testing was tens and tens of thousands of dollars. Actors would back out and then come back in. And we were just having to adjust to all, you know, we had to change directors. We had to change coasts. So it was an unbelievable sort of boulder to push up the hill. And so that's why, you know, we think so many, we've gone over in our head so many times, my God, if we didn't have Michael as our sort of our quarterback, because he quarterbacked the whole thing. I mean, he literally just nothing stopped him. The world was literally shut down and all he could think about was how are we going to keep the movie going? How are we going to do it safely? How are we going to do it responsibly? But how are we going to do it? It was just nothing put a skip in his step. I mean, it was just, it truly, truly was just amazing, unbelievable to watch.
So, Jeff, how long have you been writing scripts with your brother?
Well, it's probably been 4 years, I guess. Yes, whenever The Retaliator started.
So, was that the first one that you wrote together?
Yeah, that was the first one we wrote together. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I had dabbled a little bit, you know, when I was, you know, maybe like, you know, my first year in college kind of a thing. But it didn't go anywhere. And I think, Darren, you even dabbled a bit, too, probably around the same age I was at that time.
I dabbled early, too. I couldn't even get through. I couldn't get through one script. I tried.
Yeah, I couldn't either. Yeah.
It was, you know, embarrassingly terrible. what was written. And with Jeff and I, we've technically been writing together 4 years, but being brothers and growing up together and watching hours of cinema together, it's like we're very
making camcorder movies too, you know what I mean?
Films growing up and an endless amount of just ridiculous short films to make each other laugh and make our friends laugh and stuff.
Yeah.
So we've sort of been always in that and then we did music together for years too, so you know, we've always had that creative thing. Truly sitting down and writing was something we always fantasized about.
Right.
And it just took finally going, hey, you want to do this? You want to just, and no pressure, let's just do it. And we didn't tell anybody. We just did it. We dove into educating ourselves for a few years. Yeah. Just real, real sitting down and.
Yeah. Ben Garrett and, Thomas Lennon were a big help because, you know, they're fantastic screenwriters. So really looked up to them a lot, especially in the beginning and just wrapping our head around like, okay, how do we really write a movie? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so, I think that's, you know, so people might, I've got an idea story, but that's different than you have a cool idea, but to actually sit down and write it into something that makes sense and you can film is completely different.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And even in even a big jump from like a finished script to, okay, this is great, but we can't shoot all this, so we need some rewrites, you know? So, and that actually was a lot of fun, figuring out the rewrites. Like, okay, okay, we can't afford a, you know, a baseball field. Okay, let's, you know, let's do something else. How are we going to do that? So it was a lot of fun kind of figuring out those puzzles too.
Yeah. Now, how does the actual writing together work? Like, do you guys butt head a lot, or do you guys are generally on the same page, and maybe one is better at something else than the other one?
We don't really, I don't think we don't really ever butt heads in any way ever.
No,
we,
not really.
We spend a long time in the outlining phase, and we do. So that's really hanging and talking and mapping the movie out pretty meticulously. And so that there's a lot of trial and error and a lot of, you know, design that kind of goes into that, because we're definitely big fans too of putting together, you know, our goal is to try to make, you know, write a screenplay that takes you to, you know, some familiar territory. We love homages and things like that, but we all ultimately love to take a left turn and really take the audience to a place ultimate, hopefully, that they just do not see coming, and really kind of subvert genres and things like that. So we really have a lot of fun mapping that out, figuring that out. We watch movies, we look at references, we do a lot of research and things like that when it calls for it. And then when it comes time to actually write the script, we just bounce back and forth. There's no real system. It's just sometimes I'll write X amount of pages or he will, or we'll pick a scene, or, you know, then we'll double back over that scene. It just sort of, you know, it's very nice to have a partner that you share so many sensibilities with, because we keep each other in check. We're really brutal in a friendly way with everything, you know. Nah, yeah. I don't like that. Okay. And it's like, as I always say, if Jeff doesn't like something I'm excited about, I pretty much will just drop it, because it's like, okay, I want him to be pumped about it. And
right.
And it just kind of works that way both ways. So it's pretty easy.
Yeah. So you mentioned some rewrites. So how close is The Retaliators, the finished film, to what you originally wrote?
Surprisingly, very close.
Yeah.
I mean, aside from like I said, maybe like certain kind of location changes, or like, you know, the villains in the original were like, it was like a Russian mob or something. We changed that to like a biker gang, but essentially all the elements of that didn't change. I mean, there was still a head boss of that gang, you know what I mean? That was the, you know, things like that. Yeah. I would say what's actually really cool is that, you know, and I was expecting this, learning a lot of screenwriting in the beginning from, you know, Thomas Lennon and Ben Garrett, was like, don't expect your first film to be anything that you wrote. You know what I mean? Like, once you hand it off to a director or get it sold, you know, there's a lot of cases of writers going to see their film, you know, getting made, and they're like, what the hell is this? They didn't keep most of it or whatever, you know what I mean? And what was so fun for us, especially with, you know, working with Michael, he was so passionate about getting what was on our page onto the screen as closely as possible. And that was awesome. You know what I mean? So it's like, when we watch the film, we feel like we're watching what we have had in our head from day one, you know, and that's really special.
Yeah, certainly a good amount changed in some of the specifics, and
right.
And there's some things in there, you know, you can't win them all. You know, there are some things that, you know, that weren't exactly what we wrote, but for the most part, we had an unbelievable amount of consultation with everything, because of exactly what Jeff said. You know, we were included in everything, and anything that needed to be rewritten, it was essentially most of the time it was because of the situation being in the pandemic, and so then we would have to shuffle and change. And right. what we were so fortunate is the head of our studio, Alan Kovac, he was he had the vision, you know, he was the guy with the vision for the music and the bands and the soundtrack, and right. and he had really high standards as far as, okay, if we didn't get that scene right because we ended up getting shut down or because we ended up struggling to get that done, what do we need to do to make this an A? I don't want this to be B. How do we get this to A or A plus? So it gave us the opportunity to go, okay, well, how can we make this better? How can we do this again, but do it right. the way we really want to? But it's all the same beats that are in the script. It's just different, you know, right. different multiple, you know, different variation on it, basically.
Right.
So I talk about who directed here. Let me grab the name here. I should have this right here in front of me. But Samuel Gonzalez. Now, did you know him previously?
No.
You want one of the directors?
No.
So how did you find the directors? You know, who was right to make this?
You know, Bridget Smith was a director that Michael Lombardi had worked with. So that was one director, and she, you know, she did a really good job with the sort of the hometown and the family interaction, right. sort of she was really good with actors, and so, you know, just got some unbelievable performances out of, you know, like Katie Kelly, who plays Sarah, John Bishop's daughter, you know, like the performance she got from her, and just unbelievable. And then Samuel came in, that was during the pandemic, and he, you know, really talented guy, very, very, very good with the camera, very stylized. Really understood the tonal shift that needed to be executed for the third act, and so he was was great with that. And then Michael Lombardi, you know, Michael ended up directing a good chunk of the film. I think, you know, probably about 30% of the movie, and what was great, you know, Michael, again, he had just spent so long, so close to the material, he was able to just execute and step in and just really make it happen.
Yeah.
He was phenomenal.
When you have three directors, they're actually directing three different like parts of the movie. So they're not all there together. Like, you know,
No, it was different part. It was different parts of the movie. And again, unusual because of our the starting and stopping that we had to right. go through to get the movie done. So it was certainly not what was planned from the beginning, but it was by hook or by crook. Yeah. It was how we had to get the movie.
Right. Done. Right. And it was having, you know, Michael, you know, producing it from like the bird's eye view the whole time. You know, and knowing the story so well, that helped keep it all stitched together well. And Randy Bricker as well.
Our editor was
our rock star editor. He really helped with that as well. You know, he was there for that too.
And you mentioned a few times like the tonal shift and it's kind of different genres. I always like that about movies in general. And you usually only see them like at festivals. Whereas, you know, something either doesn't fit into one genre, there are multiple genres, right. and, you know, I dig that. But was there any point in time where people were like, well, you have to make this more, you know, one way or the other, like make it straight horror or make it an action movie or anything like that?
You have no idea. I'm sure you do have an idea because being a fan of that, as we are too. We love, you know, movies like Audition or, you know, Hostel, you know, you could name a bunch, you know, just
Leprechaun, movies that, Back to the Hood.
Yeah, of course. Back to, well, yeah, Back to the Hood again, you know. but, you know, those kind of left turns are just absolutely, you know, From Dusk Till Dawn's another great one too.
Oh yeah, it's a great one. Yeah.
Those are our, we love that.
Love
and
those.
It's so it's just such a fun trip in a film.
Yeah.
And, you know,
if you
really
could just be like laughing by the third act, like it gets you giggly when it almost does that sharp turn. And then batshit crazy. It's like, I love that involuntary laughter. It almost evokes out of me when I watch those kind of films. And we were definitely trying to do something like that.
Well, and it goes back to Hitchcock, right? I mean, it's like Psycho is
Sure.
You know,
yeah.
I'm sure there must be an example earlier than that, but certainly I don't know of anyone in popular
right.
zeitgeist that's as big as that tonal shift where you're, you know, especially as bold as you're following one protagonist. There's no way on earth anyone at that time, especially, or if it's the first time you've seen the film, that you are going to think that this person's going to die and that now we're going to completely switch perspectives and end up in this just insanity, you know, which is just so, yeah, that's just always something we've loved. And oh my gosh, I couldn't tell you how many times people either said, you know, without naming any names or anything, but just listen, this first part is a thriller. Let's make the whole thing right. a thriller. Let's just, everything should be a thriller. Right. Or, well, this thing just gets so insane. The insanity is so batshit in the third act. Well, then let's make that the movie.
Right.
And you know, this isn't good. This doesn't make sense. And when we were editing it, you know, I mean, again, and if it wasn't for Michael just fighting day one to the end, you know, we fought and fought and fought to through all of the taking in the different points of views to keep and maintain that. And it was not easy. And
yeah,
when it was done, we were satisfied, like, okay, I think we, with it, considering all of the obstacles and all of the fucking insanity and all of the objections and all, I think we pulled off what we were going for. But then we were left with the thought, fuck, is anybody gonna go on this ride, you know, because
appreciate it. We felt it as much fun as we were having.
Yeah, when we watched it on the soundstage for the first time, we were alone doing mixing and we watched the whole thing and we just went, boy, this is quite a journey. This is just a trip. And and the tones are, you know, there is some whiplash in there. And our biggest shock truly was that, you know, we got accepted. We didn't know if anybody would get the film. And we got into Fright Fest, which was the first festival we got into. Little did we know, we had no connections to these festivals. There were no relationships built with these festivals.
And for people who don't know, it's very hard to get into a festival without that.
Right.
Especially the major ones.
Yes, no, it's you're right. It's very famously, festivals are famous for being very political as far as getting in and who you know. And
right.
When I say we knew no one, I mean, there was no one, no connections to these festivals. So we were literally going, will we get in one? And little did we know we would get in over 30, and do so well in the festivals. And when Fright Fest was the very, very first one, and they it also coincided with our reviews. We had about 40 or 50 reviews that were all embargoed. And so we had no clue how good or bad they were going to be. And I always tell the story, and we always laugh about it, you know, Jeff and I going out to lunch the day before. And this was the day before we were premiering in Fright Fest. And we were psyching each other up going, okay, look, we're going to wake up. We're going to get fucking eviscerated tomorrow. The critics are going to say, this is the fucking stupidest thing they've ever seen. and what we were able to sleep at night going, fuck all that. It doesn't matter. We're happy with what we did. Right. And if five people get it, if the genre heads like ourselves, we had a feeling genre heads would get it, and people that love exploitation cinema and grindhouse, and if we really tried to subversively sneak an exploitation film into sort of a mainstream sort of kind of revenge. It's like, oh, I've seen that revenge kind of thriller before, and it's like, but we snuck in sort of in the back door a lot of 80s and action splatter, you know, homages, and went full tilt. We woke up the next morning to just, you know, four stars. The Fright Fest called us and said we had the crowd pleaser of the festival, and we about fell out of our, you know, fell out of our shoes. I mean, we were just like, really? They got it that much? Like, to this day, we still don't, you know, still don't believe it. And we're now sitting at 84% on Rotten Tomatoes, and we're just like, how is this happen? Because we always laugh at the movies that get so shit on, you know. I think Hostel.
I think it was Hostel, like in the 50s.
I think Hostel. Like no, 50s. I think it's in the 40s. I think Hostel's
is Hostel?
Like,
no.
43%.
And like, Green Inferno. Okay. So 30s. Green Inferno was like a 38, and then Knock Knock was like at like 37. I love all those movies. You know what I mean? So it's like, movies. Gosh, man.
Yeah.
So we were like, yeah. Well, I mean, we'll be lucky to do as well as those films. Like, you know what I mean?
Now, so what that year at Fright Fest? Did you guys go to Fright Fest that year? Because during COVID, a lot of the festivals ended up being virtual. I don't know if
we didn't go.
We were this close.
We planned to go, and then Darren unfortunately contracted, you know, the old COVID. Yeah. You know, and that was before the jab. So
this was the first year back in person. So this was 21.
Okay. Yeah,
21. And so we were, I mean, to say excited about going to London. I mean,
we bought tickets and everything.
We had plane tickets the whole nine, man. We were ready to roll, and that was without knowing what a hit it was going to be there too. We had no idea that it was going to be like sold out and play so well. We wanted to be there so bad, but it was in those early days where travel was just starting up, and it was very. Very, very tough.
Oh, and I couldn't, you know, and also it was meant to be too, because I couldn't get my passport. There was a huge passport issue. I think I might have been able to do it if I went to one of those, like, you know, emergency places like 3 days before. But remember, I had a huge passport issue.
That's right. Yeah. Everything, you know, it was just those COVID days. Were just nuts. Everything was hard, you know.
Yeah. It's too bad, because Fright Fest, a huge festival, multiple screens, multiple theaters, actually.
Yeah.
And I don't want to make you guys feel bad, but I just got back from Fright Fest a few weeks ago, so it's a good time.
No, we will forever have them, just the warmest place in our hearts for them being the first, and the head of Fright Fest, one of them, Paul McAvoy.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
Just was a great guy, and he just championed our film, and he went on the record with a phenomenal review right up front, and he just was he was incredible, and so yeah, that was the, you know, but yes, I mean, when I tell you, I couldn't even explain to you the amount of things that were challenged and that we kind of had to fight through creatively. It was insane, but I guess what do you expect? What do you expect? We knew we were, it's such an underdog.
It was a hard sell. Rough. Yeah.
It's a hard sell. And if you don't get it, if you don't understand that kind of cinema, I can understand it seems insane. It's just that, you know, that's, it's going to be a fight, you know, the pushing the envelope like that.
Yeah. But yeah, it was the first time I flew since the pandemic. Was the last 2 years have been very strange, but you know, I'm glad. Yeah. That did you, so before the theatrical release last week, did you get the chance to see it with an audience before that?
Yeah. Scream
Fest.
Did we? Yeah.
Scream Fest. That's right. Yeah. That was awesome. Yeah.
We're about 30 miles south of LA. So Scream, we got to open Scream Fest, another absolutely just unbelievable festival. And
that's right.
We our movie opened the festival at the Hollywood Chinese Theater.
Yeah.
With a sold out crowd. I mean, we had the full red carpet and the whole deal, and it played like a rock concert. I mean, it just, that third act, that was the first time seeing it in front of an audience, and it was just to hear people yelling at the screen and squirming from the kills and laughing at the kills and get applause breaks at certain kills, and you know, and there's an eyeball moment in the
don't give too much away now.
I won't give away
come on
what
now.
Happens with the eyeball, but I will say,
I just like that phrase, an eyeball moment.
It was an eyeball moment, and I mean the whole theater.
We just mean don't look away. Okay? Yeah,
the whole theater squirmed and groaned all at once, and it was like,
yeah, that was good.
Fun. I mean, it was just amazing.
Yeah, I just went to see Fabio Frizzi in Boston, and they played Zombie 2, and there's a very memorable eyeball moment.
Oh yeah,
phrase, but yeah.
Great eyeball moment.
I really enjoyed watching Retaliators at home, but the whole time I was watching, I was like, this would play really well on the big screen for multiple reasons.
Yeah.
Like the audience interaction, because people interact with the with kills and with some comedy, so I think they've been to a lot of that stuff. And also something that people overlook sometimes, I think, is music plays really well in a theater.
Yeah.
It does, man. It really does. And I really do think it's, you know, and I think this comes from writing it together too, in a weird way, is like, this is a movie to see with your friends.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Or like, yeah, because there is something about laughing at it together, and, you know, I think that's why, you know, I love that we got the theatrical release, because, you know, just so much more likely people are going to see it with other people, like their friends and stuff. So, yeah.
And we keep talking about like the, it's crazy at the end and a lot of great kill stuff. But what I also like about it is like the big, you know, it asks a question of the audience, you know, would you, if you had the chance to hurt someone who hurt your loved ones, would you take it? And I love that about the movie.
Yeah. I appreciate you saying that a lot. Jeff and I, that was the movie in a nutshell. It was taking a look at that revenge fantasy and saying, let's really go there and take a character through the excruciating moral dilemma that would create. And then it was, you know, there's two characters in the movie that you learn both are confronted with that, and both make different choices, and both in both cases, big extreme things happen. And so, yeah, it was really important for us. We talked about it a lot, like that we don't want to telegraph any messaging in the movie, and we're just not fans of that. And we wanted to present the moral conflict and then truly let the audience sort of struggle with it and place themselves. The goal would be to have the character to truly look at it's both characters in the film, put themselves in their position and say, gosh, would I do that? Would I not? Oh, geez, it's too far. Well, is it too far? And argue about it, and when the movie's over, think about it, talk about it. You know, that was the goal, was just to try to create something that made you just really kind of think and wrestle with those things? Because it's a tough, it's a very tough moral question when you're in that. If you find happen to find yourself in that position, it would be tough for anybody.
I actually think that, I think the fun kills and stuff really, the contrasts are actually really makes that actually more powerful, because it, you can also even kind of look, hey, I'm laughing at all this, these kills and craziness. And then you're like, well, if it was really happening, you know, should I be laughing at it? So it kind of all
Works
each other, I think, you know?
Yeah.
Now tell us, Neil, what would you do?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I would like to say no, but I don't think it's really something you can answer unless you're put in that position.
Yeah, that's
what makes it a fun moral quandary, I think, is that it is such a hard one. You know, you can think of, you can consider it theoretically, but what you will practically do in those situations, it is a bit hard to say.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think I would go full, you know, I mean, there's probably certain lines I can say I won't cross.
Right, right.
Yeah. But, yeah. but you never know, right?
Yeah. I think hopefully you won't know, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that is I think that is what's fun about it, is that I think you pull most people are going to say, I don't think I would do that or could do that. I think we all probably feel that way. What we tried to create in the movie was to take you through a circumstance where, you know, it would be extremely difficult and tempting not to. And who would
you?
And then that was where the idea of the pastor came from, because
we
said, what would be the, who would be the longest stretch to pull in that direction? It would be a turn the other cheek, truly good. Like, you know, we were going, this guy is Jimmy Stewart. You know, this guy's Tom Hanks.
Right,
this
right.
guy's, you know, truly an earnest, good man who lives his life to be a good dad to his daughters and to be a good man of his community that tries to help and be there for his community. So that would be the longest stretch you could imagine, so that made it fun. That made it instantly like, okay, that would be interesting. How could, you know, how do we do that?
Yeah. And I also think what makes it a fun or an interesting moral quandary that the film poses is that it, even if you figured out what you should do, it's not the same thing as what you would do.
Right.
And I think that's what makes it, you know, sort of tantalizing to consider. It's like, you know, I know I shouldn't do that, but what would I do in that situation? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Also, now that I think about it, when you mentioned that he's the man of the cloth, it's really rare in modern movies for the last 20 years or so where a religious character is a good guy.
Right.
I'm not even a religious person, but
yeah,
I think
not diddling kids,
it's kind of, you know. I think it's a cheap thing to go to all the time. Anytime there's a religious person, they're automatically said they're diddling kids or they're some type of evil person.
You're right.
You know, it's that's sort of our, and that's in this, and in the scripts we've written subsequently, you know, that's part of where we really love to have fun, is to subvert expectations, you know, take familiar, because, you know, some tropes you can't avoid, and there's cliches you can't avoid, and because we're dealing with genre, so you're gonna have you know, the trappings of those genres, which are I see that as a good thing. But yeah, we love to sort of take a look and go, you know, that was absolutely something we thought about, that God, every pastor, you're right, last like 20 years, it's just they're really a complete alcoholic behind the scenes, or they're, you know,
right,
you know, some, or they're very, very creepy, or they're, you know, it's always that same thing. And we just were like, you know, let's subvert that, you know, no real skeletons in the closet with this guy. Let's make him Tom Hanks. Let's make him, you know, we really thought of a Frank Capra-esque town, and I love Michael always refers to Gremlins, you know, the beginning of Gremlins. And that's what, right. you know, the beginning of Gremlins is. It feels like it's a Capra-esque sort of town. And that was what we really, you know, no, this is just a good guy. He's not a perfect guy. He's, you know, right. certainly there's, he has his shortcomings and he's probably a little too overprotective, and he's probably one thing we talked about was he's, you know, he's playing life very safe and a very practical guy. And so he's a guy that's doing good things, but is definitely, right. you know, he never bought that motorcycle he's always wanted. And is sort of, that's sort of a symbolic for, you know, him sort of not really ever breaking loose. And cause that was part of the other big part of what we were doing too. Part of the joke was, here's a guy who always fantasized about being John McClane. And I think most people, anyone that loves Die Hard, I don't know how you haven't fantasized about that. Right. It's like, that's sort of a, you know, adolescent fantasy, and it that ends up getting delivered to him, but in the most horrific, under the most horrific circumstances. And again, it was right. just sort of another way to kind of subvert kind of the 80s action hero, you know, concept. Cause that was definitely a not so hidden love letter. You know, I mean, he mentions Rambo and the Terminator in his sermon, you know, and his sure. daughter refers to him watching Die Hard every day. And so, yeah.
Real quick about the priest, I thought a funny idea for like a short or something would be if it's a priest, a Santa Claus, and a clown, and they actually are trying to save the town, but no one will trust them because they're always evil in every movie.
That oh, is man, great.
That's good.
All right, we're going to steal that.
Or
we'll have to write it together.
We'll just do it together.
So festival run and then theatrical release. So where does it go from here? Where does Retaliators go?
We're going to go to VOD and we're going to go to streaming after that. The dates haven't officially been announced yet, but it will be coming up soon. It will be in the next within the next month. We're doing really well in theaters now. You know, we're getting released at, you know, different clusters of screens and theaters at a time, and we're hearing that we've been getting a really, really good per screen average and doing well. You know, it's the only way to really be able to measure yourself when you're released this small. But what's the most amazing part is we're just being flooded on social media with just amazing response and lots of audience that just that are loving the film and they're writing us personally and just talking about this is one of my new favorite movies and this is going to be my new Christmas movie and all this. So it's just been amazing.
They're writing you personally? I haven't got anything. I got one guy named Leo, but I don't even want to tell you what he wanted to do to me. So we'll just skip that.
Shout out to Leo.
No. The response has been freaking awesome, man. Yeah, it's what's the funnest part for me is like seeing people just like getting really excited about it. You know what I mean? Because, you know, we knew it wasn't going to be a movie that everyone would love, but or at least like be like meh or like kind of lukewarm on or whatever. But the fact that we got people that were, you know, clapping at the end of the freaking film, you know what I mean? And then just, you know, it's been really fun to see the reactions to it.
Yeah, it's a word of mouth gets, you know, your festival run and people talk about it and it gets, I know doing the show, I see a lot of screeners And I won't name names stuff, but there's a lot of stuff that's just very run of the mill, which to me is I'd rather watch a bad movie that's like entertaining in some way, or you could tell they're having fun or they were trying to do something than something just told that I've seen a million times, even if it's technically made well. That's very forgettable to me. But when something is I really like, it's fun to tell everyone about it. And, you know, you see a lot of that online, and I'm glad that, you know, that happens.
Absolutely. Well, and I love that you say you'd rather watch a bad movie. It's so funny. we watch together, and then I know separately too. And I'll speak for myself. I love bad movies. I mean, I find them true, and I have a true affection for them to the point where I start just truly. It gets hard to tell. Well, what I even mean by bad anymore, because there's.
We have some of those for sure. Factor.
You know,
yeah, so like Howling 7 is a big one. Like, well, I don't like saying it's a bad movie because it's like, I just love it. Like, how could I enjoy something so much and then turn around and say it's bad? You know what I mean?
And it's also, you know, I'm kind of endlessly fascinated with bad films too, because I just sort of, when something really doesn't work, it's sort of interesting, and it's also as writers, I think it's really educational, because you just kind of go, "Oh, wait a minute, okay, that's why you don't do that, because it just creates, you know."
Well, you know, I almost argue that, you know, learning from bad things is way easier than learning from good things. I find when I'm watching like if I'm watching James Cameron, who I love, you know, it's like I almost look at it like, oh man, like I'll never be that good, man. Like, you know, it almost feels like, gosh, that's impossible to do. Like, how are you going to do that again? You know?
Yeah.
But if I watch a bad film, I'll start thinking like, how could I have done that better? You know what I mean? And then I'll think, oh, that's why that didn't work. Oh, that didn't work because they didn't do this, this, and that. You know what I mean? So
yeah, if the only thing you're watching is, you know,
Spielberg,
you know,
and
Citizen Kane, and
Godfather, and the
Seven Samurai. That level of quality it does feel very unattainable, and there's something about.
Yeah.
About, you know, it's that, well, it's, you know, it's kind of in the same way, like, you know, punk rock or metal, you know, there's a way as musicians, you know, and when I was a young musician, you know, learning certain metal riffs or punk riffs gave me a way into the guitar.
Right.
You know, and there's a real, And that's not to knock those things at all, because to this day, you know, and I was a big metalhead as a kid, and I still am.
I think Basket Case is a better movie than Taxi Driver? No, but I love both movies, and I get a great enjoyment from both films. So they're I probably like them equally, but I know that, you know, one is better than the other.
And that's where you get into that thing where you just go, because I love Basket Case, and it's like, you know, I would rather watch Basket Case than most other movies. So then at a certain point, that's where you start questioning it, going how bad is it? You know, because
because it's like, it's such a bad movie, and then you just end up spending most of your time watching that.
What's to say about Citizen
Kane or whatever? Yeah.
that's what we always say. That's what's great about, you know, that's what's great about cinema being alive today, having the choices we have. Everybody seems to be absolutely so binary about, well, you either must love, you know, French New Wave, or you, you know, you're an idiot and you only like XYZ. And the truth of the matter is, it's that we live in a world where you can love both. You can love any different.
You can love Shawshank and you can love Escape Plan. You know what exactly. I mean? There's nothing wrong with liking both those films, you know?
That's how I grew up watching, you know, tons of movies, and I like a lot of what people would call bad movies, and I love, you know, some of the all-time classics. Even, I go to the movies every week, too, and I'll go see some crazy Bollywood movie, and then I'll see some crazy horror movie, and I'll see a superhero movie, whatever, you know?
Right.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing, you know, and
I enjoyed Infinity War and stuff, yeah.
There's a lot of, you know, at any kind of art, you always end up with elitism to you know, especially typically with critics and audiences too, you know, you get elitism where people, you know, you can only like one thing, or films have to do this or they have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you know, that's why we're very committed to when we write, just not caring about that and not looking, just hey, right. what entertains us and what is amusing, and follow that. And I think if, you know, I think you go at that angle, I think people will, you know, we hope, you know, that people just appreciate, hey, we're going to try to send you on a different journey than you typically go on. You know, we're not reinventing the wheel,
right?
We're going to take some turns that just you won't expect. And because this is the thrill we get from exploitation cinema, and hopefully it leads some people to check it out and, you know, go deep dive, you know, because it's so funny, you know, as extreme as people think our movie is, it's only because it's wrapped around kind of a little more of a mainstream package. It's like movies get way more insane than,
oh gosh, yeah,
than our movie. But it's all about context too, because there's a lot of, that's the other part we like. We like a heart in there too. You know, we like there being good, you know, good characters and sort of that blend, you know?
Mm-hmm. So, well, what were some of the movies when you guys were growing up that you guys watched together and made you like, hey, let's start making our own movies?
Oh boy. All time faves.
Yeah. I got to think of movies you like. Movies that you showed me. Oh yeah, Lost Boys. That's
one behind my head. Yeah. Lost Boys is my. Yeah. I always say it's probably my favorite movie of all time.
I still believe it's so good. Good, man.
You know, perfect film. Just perfect. I can watch it just endlessly. I love that movie so much.
And its ability to make you, you know, laugh and feel like it's a little goofy, but then get really serious and scary, you know. I mean, yeah, I mean, that's it gets that mix just right, you know.
Yeah very it's a very singular movie too. It's just there's just no other movie that combines those tones in that way.
Yeah,
you know, it's just very, very unique. But yeah, we you know, oh geez,
like The Shining. I remember, because you know, Darren's, you know, 10 years older than me. So when I was growing up, he was kind of schooling me on film. You know what I mean? And I remember The Shining was a big one. Just in terms of just a movie that will, you know, freak you the fuck out, but also, you know, but it's a slow burn. You know, it's a slow burn kind of film. You know. I really love that about it. Halloween.
John Carpenter. It all starts with John Carpenter. I mean, Halloween left the biggest impact on me. I saw it way, 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 way too young. It completely warped my brain. And then I just, you know, going down, you know, to the Thing and, you know, The Fog and Assault on Precinct 13 and you know, Escape from New York. I mean, it's just that early run of Carpenter is just was an enormous, enormous influence. And then I'm trying to think.
For me as a kid, it was probably more. Or like growing up, it was definitely a lot of Quentin Tarantino, because I remember being kind of a young teenager and really it was Pulp Fiction, you know, Reservoir Dogs. Those movies really kind of effed me up a bit You know what I mean? Yeah. I remember the first time seeing, I was like, dude, I must have been like 10 or 11 years old when I saw Pulp Fiction for my first time with my buddy. And I'm telling you, when we got to the Gimp scene, we were like, what the fuck are we watching? Like, we were like, you know, that weird, like yeah, you can do this Gimp, in a movie?
Yeah.
Like, what is going on right now, right. You know?
Yeah. Well, you didn't really see, especially, you know, now you might see something crazy like that in festival, but you didn't see something like that in a mainstream film.
No. I was a huge
thing impact on me.
Yeah, Reservoir Dogs was very, very formative. I watched that on a loop and Pulp Fiction, of course, and a big 80s. Yeah, I love 80s action. Love all
all the Arnie movies. Chuck Norris and Bronson. You know,
huge Bronson, huge Arnold,
Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, we're big. To the Don Siegel era. You know, the Dirty Harrys and of course Sergio Leone. Westerns and yeah, we're kind of all over the place. You know, and then we're the whole canon. The whole canon films catalog. I mean, we to this day dig through those all the time. I still collect a ton of VHS and total VHS nerd with all that stuff. I've got God knows how many around here, but I mean, just like you said, sort of just little event, you know, love the good stuff. And I was talking about French New Wave. I wasn't even meaning it disparagingly.
Right.
Just recently, we've been digging into some French New Wave stuff and really loving it. I mean, there's good stuff in everything. You know, it's just everywhere. We could just go on all day long with all of it. You know.
Yeah. Probably a brilliant formative movie for me younger too. I know it's going to sound a little goofy, but it was definitely Jack Frost 2, Revenge of the Mutant Killer Snowman.
It's a great that I'm a big fan of the first two Jack Frost films.
Dude, they are so good, man. I mean, they're good, bad films.
Oh yeah. It's the best, the snowman, rape scene.
Oh, in the first one, right?
Yeah, in the first one. Great.
Listen, I normally don't like to admit out loud about loving a rape scene. That rape scene.
That's probably not a good thing to admit.
Right? That rape scene. Listen, take me down if you're going to take me down. Is a damn good rape scene. I'm sorry. Until you've seen a snowman. And he raped Shannon Elizabeth, right?
Right.
So, Jack Frost 2 is, oh my god, it is
well, so that has the greatest, that has my favorite death scene, which is the Cowatunga dude, the tongue gets ripped, ripped off the pole,
there's some great
that's one the best one
and yeah. Jack,
they're playing my song. Yeah.
I always have had a soft spot for Christmas horror movies in general. The real terrible ones and the very good ones like Gremlins and stuff. I don't know. There's something about them that they have a charm to them that I
they do. I think that's what was subconsciously pushing us very early on making Retaliators a Christmas movie. Right. You know what I mean? It was just our affection for, Die Hard, like we mentioned,
Gremlins,
Gremlins, yeah. Jack Frost 2, Revenge of the Mutant Killer Snowman.
Jeff, I am
Eyes Wide Shut. Don't leave Jeff, that puppy out. Jeff. One of my favorites. Yeah.
I am very disappointed in you that you are listing the pantheon of great Christmas films. And you still haven't named Santa Jaws? What's wrong with you?
This is one I've not seen. I'm going to have to seek out.
Oh, buddy.
Oh, dude, we watch it every year. You got to see it.
You listen to me.
Uh-huh.
If you love fucking subversive Christmas films, you are not going to top Santa Jaws.
You can't really top it.
As the fin goes by, there's a fucking Santa hat on the fin going by. It's unbelievable. You have to do it. Have to do it.
I'm gonna watch. I'm gonna seek this out. Santa Jaws.
It's a very bizarre mechanism, which what brings it to life too. I mean, you gotta see it. It's a weird movie, but I love it. Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah, I love it too. This sounds great. By the way, I was telling Jeff before it live before you logged on, Darren. My brother normally does a show with me. He's 9 years older, and so I was always watching horror movies with him. Because we have a single mom, and she would take him to the drive-ins and instead of getting a babysitter, just bring me along. So I was watching, you know, all kinds of stuff. And I was like five or something. But
yeah. Oh yeah, Neil, we're in the same boat, man. Yeah, just having a big brother show us all the great movies, you know.
Right. Same here with the mom taking us to the drive-in too. We grew up.
Yeah.
We saw pictures of we're on double features right now with Pearl.
Very cool.
Which is an honor because we love Ty West.
Ty West is the shit. Yeah.
Yeah.
And when I saw that, that was like, wow, that hit me hard because the drive-in is such a sacred place for me because I saw so many classics at the drive-in. And then you got to see those great double features that I had no business seeing. And my mom just didn't know the difference. So next thing you know, we're watching like Night of the Comet or we're watching fucking, you know, who knows? I mean, it was just an endless amount of, you know, movies we shouldn't have been watching. But it was, that was, and Jeff was, you know, a little baby or a toddler. There, and we're watching, you know, Poltergeist 3 or Child's something.
Yeah.
But no, I agree. By the way, you mentioned VHS. This was the first VHS tape my mom bought me. I think there's a glare on it, but
it's no a way. Creep
show in the clamshell. And so I always have kept
hell it. Yeah.
The tape is actually that's worn awesome, out, but I kept the clamshell.
Oh, buddy. That's cool, man.
That is fucking awesome. Here, I'll show you. I'll give you.
Yeah, show off the cassettes.
I got some. So that's Tower Records Shelby. Oh,
very cool. I like even just the horror. The banner there. Yeah.
So then there's we've got Lisa from Weird Science over there.
Okay, very cool.
A Raft and
Retaliators poster.
Yeah, we got some Retaliators business going on.
Don't skip over Magnum Force, dude.
Huh? Oh, I didn't mean to.
There we go.
Yeah.
The mechanic, yeah. Yeah, great posters, man.
And if you're listening to this on the podcast version, skip over to Spotify or YouTube, and you'll see what we're talking about.
Love it.
Yeah. Well, do you guys have anything, you know, in the works? I know you got Retaliators coming out, and it's at the theater, and VOD coming in the future. But are you guys working on anything for the future?
We have a romantic period piece set in the medieval times. No, I'm just kidding.
yes, and it's called Jack Frost 3. Things get medieval. No, we
I'm on board.
It's not a bad idea, you know. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, we have a couple of scripts that we have been working really hard on and polishing and we're really excited about. So we've got some good meetings coming up and people interested, and so yeah, it's some good stuff. We're very pumped on, and then and then we're ready to rock Retaliators too. If there's enough demand for it, we're ready to go. We've got it outlined. We already, when we wrote it originally, we kind of knew, okay, here's where a sequel would be. This is what we kind of have.
Yeah, this is where you find out. So. Yeah. I mean, not to give too much away, but this will be the sequel will be where you find out that Bishop's been a serial killer all along. Mm. And, no, I'm just kidding. Yeah. Well, maybe. I don't know. Who knows? We have, you know.
Yeah. And for people who don't know, I had Michael Lombardi on, I think this last week. And you can tell that he's very excited about the movie and very proud of it. And I like to see that, you know, someone proud of their work and really
as he should be.
Yeah.
His acting was just phenomenal, man.
Performance in it is off the charts. Yeah, absolutely.
And where can people follow you guys to see what you're up to?
We're on Instagram. It's the underscore gear underscore brothers, and it's gear GEARE. So we're on Instagram. We post stuff there pretty regularly. And then we are on Twitter at Gear Brothers. And then also to find out what a theater near you playing the Retaliators right now, if you go to retaliatorsmovie.com, it automatically pops up wherever you live. It will right. Show you what theaters or drive-ins near you are playing right now.
Very cool. All right. Well, this has been very fun to talk with you guys, and I think we should do it again sometime.
Let's do it. Absolutely, man. Anytime.
Do it, man.
Anytime.
Thanks, guys. This has been great.
Thank you.
Have a great night, man. Thanks so much.